myself before, but for those of you that have never seen me, I'm John Weisenberger. I live in Minnesota, Owatonna, Minnesota. An hour south of the Twin Cities. I'm a pastor at a church, and I also teach at a community college, and it's actually in the jail. So it's inside and outside students coming together. If you want to ask me about that, we'll do that later. So right now, we'll jump into Taoism and Confucianism. And I'd just like to ask, what anyone have any experience with Confucianism? Other than what Confucius say. What's the one that everyone knows? I can't remember. The high on pot one. What's that one? You stand on a toilet, get high on pot. That's the one. Someone always brings that up in every class I teach, I don't know why, but I'll bring it up. Yeah.
We were actually at a Confucian ceremony when we were in Korea. We were invited to a family's ancestor worship.
Yep.
Yeah. They said they rarely invite people who aren't part of the circle.
Sure.
They were positive parents who were not. Incredible.
Ancestor worship is something that fits right into Confucian practice. Confucianism, as we'll see, is really focused on the order of relationships in society. So, how about Taoism? Anyone know Taoism a little bit? Yeah, a lot of it? Okay. Well, that's not road grader, loud. Well, the place, before we can jump into either Taoism or Confucianism, we need to go back a little bit, and I talked about the Axis Age, if you know. The Axis Age, what year was it for those of you been here before?
500 BC.
Yeah, give or take 100 years, 500 BC, E for those of you that are religious scholars. Breaking out of the Christian tradition. So the Axis Age, just to quickly recap it, is a time when everything in the world changed dramatically. So in Greece, it was sort of the advent of the philosophers or the dawning of Greek philosophy. In the Middle East, and for the Hebrews, it was the transition from ritual sacrifice into the prophets and the call for justice. In the Buddha came to India and changed Hinduism into a form of Buddhism. And also, at the same time, Hinduism was transforming through the Upanishads, the philosophy of the ritual practice of Hinduism. In China, they had, the whole world was pretty much worshiping by ritual sacrifice in some form. And in China, Carol just mentioned ancestor worship. That was a form of ritual sacrifice, remembering the ancestors who were considered to be, move on to deity almost. And you would ask for their protection because they could kind of navigate the spiritual world for you in your family. And so in China, the Axis Age really comes to be through the two people that make it happen. Lao Tzu, and Confucius. So, the phoneticisms, the way it's spelled, if you know the old style Taoism, you would always confuse people that had never seen it before, right? How is Tao spelled? T-A-O. And the newbies would always say Tao, and the ones that knew their stuff would say, yeah, that's Tao. And now the way they write it has changed. There's really a movement around the world to get rid of the old non-phonetic way of saying Taoism. So you'll see that in the notes. The Tao now is spelled D-A-O. It's not Tao Te Ching anymore. It's Tao Te Ching. It's one word, more closer to the Chinese. So Lao Tzu, this means teacher, the Z-I at the end in Zhonghua in Chinese. And the Lao, it means old. So he's old teacher. And I can't remember, Kung means wise. I can't remember anymore. But Confucius is the only thing in religious studies that has, using his name as the English translation, Confucius is the only thing that survived sort of the re-phoneticization of the word. So Lao Tzu is in about 600 he's born, and Confucius is born in about 550. BCE, yeah, 551 BCE. So, about 2,500 years ago, 2,600 years ago. These two guys ran into or changed the nature of the way Chinese looked at the world. And the basic understanding of ancient Chinese thought is this. Everyone knows what this is going to be, right? Yes, one on the side. Okay. What's this called? Right. So what is that? I remember when I was younger, I had a first of my church say it was a New Age symbol of the devil. Well, not quite. The yin-yang. Yin-yang is sort of the underpinning of ancient Chinese understanding of really everything. So this is not understood as a static thing. When you look at the yin-yang symbol, it is basically moving and spinning, dynamic and active. So the black is the seed of the yin inside the yang. And the white spot, the yang, is the seed of the light inside the yin. So it's moving, and you can see it's a wave, right? We had Vespers last night, there it is. The wave is in there, and it's moving and spinning, active and dynamic. The yin is moving into the yang is moving into the yin all the time. Okay. So that's the understanding of the yin and yang symbol. Which one, what's yin? For, we'll put yin over here. What is yin? You guys in the back, who said? Dark is one, what else?
Female,
yep.
Evil?
I wouldn't qualify it as evil. We'll put that over here and talk about that. Okay, what else?
Passive,
thank you.
Cool?
Yeah, that's
metal
a good one. I like that.
Moon.
Throw them out there, what?
Moon.
I think you could go there. Definitely moon. Yep, astrological.
Oh my
God. What else?
Receptive.
Okay, yes. In terms of the female, too, receiving, right. Yeah. Receive. That's pretty good. Okay, yang.
Light.
Light, yeah, all the opposites, right? Pairs of opposites.
Male.
Yeah, action. This would be, the big one over here really is, what's the word? What's the best word? Yeah, I write these words down. I don't even remember which one I'm going to use. Yeah, unmanifest is the best word. So, yin is unmanifest. And yang is revealed. What else would yang be? Yep, hot, we're going hot.
Sun.
Maybe sun. Lots of ways you can do that. So yin and yang gets interpreted in everything, right? In relationships. Which one, especially in Taoism, Confucianism is not really a mystical practice or religious practice. Confucianism is really an ethical system. So when you look at Taoism and Confucianism, religious scholars often think that they're aspects of one another. In fact, they look at Chinese and the Chinese society as elements of Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism all rolled together. They say almost every Chinese person has an aspect of all three in their daily lives and their daily practice. So, and especially in Taoism, which one is the more powerful?
Yin.
Yeah, why? Why is darkness and passivity, non-action, female, why is that more powerful? Doesn't make sense, right, from a Western perspective. I mean, the West is yang, right? We're all about this stuff over here. Let's get something done. Let's get to work. Don't sit around. Let's see what you got.
A drop of water can wash away a stone.
Okay, we'll get to that in Taoism. That's good. We'll get there. But how about, I'm going to just push you a little bit to think about, why would yin, a concept that I think for us as Westerners is just so foreign, why would yin be more powerful? It doesn't make any sense, does it? That darkness would be more powerful than light, especially from a Christian tradition standpoint.
Without the dark, you have no light?
Okay, say more. You're getting to where I want to go.
Does the dark provide an environment to birth?
That's even better. We're getting there. Okay. Yeah, even in the, I would say, a Taoist in the Christian tradition would say, what comes first? Right? Mm-hmm. God broods over what? The darkness. You know, the darkness is this potentiality. How you can measure all these. How big is emptiness? That's really, this is empty. And this is full. How big is emptiness? How big is the void? How large is darkness? Can you measure the light in this room? You can measure it. If you know how full something is, can you measure that? Does the universe have a measurable quantity about it that scientists can see? Yes, it does. The revealed things in this universe do, but how about the unrevealed parts? Is there a limit to those?
No.
What is the universe sitting in? What's the majority of gravity produced by in this universe that we live in? Stuff we can't see. Right? Dark matter. Right? 20% or less of the universe is revealed to our eyes and our sensors. And the rest is the iceberg underneath. That's why yin is more powerful from an Eastern perspective. All right, got it? Anything else about yin yang? I know we got to keep moving on here.
Well, there's not a sense of good bad with that. We're
not so much, right?
In our theology, it's black or dark, good bad.
Right. For us, you know, good is over here in the light, mm-hmm. and evil is over there in the dark. But this is a dynamic energy always moving into itself. So they're both powers, and they both do good. And they both do evil, right? And we can understand, even as Westerners, how you know too much yang can be a bad thing. Right? Balance. Yes, who said that? Balance. It's all about balance. So yin and yang is all about maintaining the balance. Taoism is about balance. Even Confucianism, too. Can I erase this? Actually, I didn't need to, maybe. Okay, so where does Confucianism and Taoism begin? Well, there are two things you can see in here. Terms. Chinese practice, and they still practice it today, but the two main senses of, how do I say this? Communicating with the world and the universe and the spirits, the Chinese people going way, way back usually had two ways of doing it, besides sort of a sense of prayer or veneration. One was divination, and the other was alchemy. So divination and alchemy are a big part of ancient Chinese practice and life. So what is divination?
The divine.
The divine,
making something divine.
How about, like, you know what we call divination?
Hearing the future, foretelling.
Foretelling, right. So, you know, that kind of prophetic future telling. How about finding water? That's a form of divination, right? Dowsing rods. So they walk and you find that. There's tons of it, right? Palm reading. Tea leaves, you know, all these Chinese ways that are. What other ways do you know?
Astrology.
Yeah, seance is kind of more of Western.
Horoscope. Oh, well, that's a.
What's that?
Horoscopes.
tarot cards, right? Whatever ways you can tell something about the spiritual or the future, that's divination. So the Chinese practice divination, you know, way back. The other alchemy, what's alchemy? Right, lead into gold, especially in Europe, you know, the Western idea. Finding the essence of the physical world. So turning lead into gold, that was the early understanding. But finding out how, you know, liquids and chemicals work and what is the elemental source of the physical. And so between these two, let's see, we'll put values. So Confucius really takes a sense of divination, and there's all these books by the magicians, they start to write them down. And when Confucius comes along in about 500, he looks at them and he begins to reinterpret all these magic books, these divining magic books, and he turns them into philosophy. It's pretty cool. It's kind of what the Upanishads did to Indian practice, but you know it's different for Chinese. So early divination, one of the most common forms was taking bones, goat bones, chicken bones, and so the magician, the diviner, what would he do with the bones? Now this is the theory that goes back way back. You take two bones and you throw the bones and
I Ching.
We'll get to I Ching here. So, you know, basically, at its most basic form, that would mean I'd ask my question of the spirits, yes. You know, Ouija boards, another interesting example of that. And if they don't touch, that's no. So the magician would take the bones, specially prepared bones in a special circle or whatever, and throw the bones for people. People would come by, they'd ask their questions, they'd throw the bones, you know, yes to your question or no. Kind of magic eight ball. My favorite form of divination. Over time, it gets more complex. They don't use two, they use many, and it turns into chicken bones, and it turns into bamboo shoots and sticks and special sacred things, and the magicians throw those, and then they begin to write books on them. And the bones turn into something very interesting. So they start to make records of what it means. And like the first, well, that's called like a trigram. And that, the early magicians would write down the trigram of what the bones looked like, and then they'd give a meaning so that they could pass it down, they could interpret what it meant. To teach. Over time, the trigram turned into a hexagram. And so the hexagram would have meaning. This is going back, you know, 5, even maybe 10,000 years in China. And out of this, at the same time, is developing the Chinese system of writing. And what does it look like? Yeah, or pictures of things that are like the word. But really, this sort of sense of divination, this sense of the hexagram, develops how Chinese writing, and that those characters. So, so let's just look, since we're on the hexagram. This is from the I Ching, as you said, the Book of Changes. And so it talks about how things change and how you can understand it and how you can help control all these energies. It's hard to see in here, but you see this has a Chinese character on the top. It's called Ta Chu, the Taming Power of the Great. So this is basically chapter 26 in the I Ching and Confucius' interpretation in it, the Book of Changes. So can you see the hexagram there? The hexagram's made of two trigrams, one on top of the other. The first trigram is called Ken, and it means keeping still and mounting. You understand? See that? And then the one underneath it, the trigram, is Qian, the creative or heaven. And so as you look at this, it tells you, you know, if you were to throw the bones, it really starts to move into something more with personality and personality type and how you relate to the world over time. We don't really have time to go through all this, but you can take a look at left-hand column. It has 104 right in the middle. So it gives a judgment. It tells you about the taming power of the great. There's also a taming power of the small, right? And they work together. The taming power of the great, perseverance furthers. Not eating at home brings good fortune. Does that sound like a Confucius saying? That's where they... Not eating at home brings good fortune. It furthers one to cross the great water. So we're not used to hearing how this symbology works, but the masters would work these together, and you would have your own symbols according to whether you threw the bones or what sign you were born under or lots of other things. Let's see. So as you read it, I don't want to get into this too much, but hold firmly to the great creative powers, store them up as set forth in this hexagram. There is need for a strong, clear-headed man who is honored by the ruler. So this is actually Confucius giving his interpretation underneath it. Okay? And Ken indicates firmness and truth, giving points of light and clarity to the daily renewal of character. Only through such daily self-renewal can a man continue at the height of his powers. Force of habit helps to keep order in quiet times. In periods, there's great storing up of energy. So what Confucius is doing is taking this idea of this power, this spiritual power, that's outside your control, and he's moving it into this sense of character building and almost psychology of a person. And what he's doing in a really big way is taking this old superstition and turning it into a way to define the character of the superior ideal person. In a nutshell. We don't have time to really get into it, but if you flip it over, you can see this is from the Analects, Confucius' Analects, and this is his writing here on the superior person, the Junzi, or Junzi sometimes it's called, the gentleman, the noble person, the superior man, has lots of titles. But you can see some of the things he writes all about how to build up character in a person. And we're going to look at the most. He has Roman numerals. If you see Roman numeral 16. The superior man is compared to the mean man, which is kind of the man of the masses, is not interested in developing his character. Confucius says there are three things of which the superior man stands in awe. Stands in awe of the ordinance of heaven, he's in awe of great men, the words of the sages, and the mean man does not know these things. He goes on, the master says the superior man is modest of speech, but exceeds in his action. That's not what I wanted. Too brief thing. Anybody see something that sticks out at them? We can go about it that way.
Nine things which are subjects with him of thoughtful consideration.
What number is that under?
The last one. Oh, well, the last one in the long paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's, I'm just going to continue. I want to circle back into their stories a little bit. And it's hard to teach all of this together in 1 hour. I'm having difficulty figuring out how to get where I want to go. We'll come back to that. Well, as long as we did Confucius and divination, we'll do Lao Tzu. He takes the same principle in alchemy and develops it into... So, divination and alchemy. Lao Tzu takes the principle of alchemy, this trying to get to the essence of of physical things, of, you know, early chemistry and medicine and all this stuff comes out of alchemy, and he applies it spiritually. And he says, in every human being, there is an essence, a spiritual essence. And the idea is to find that and to purify it. And so that's basically where Lao Tzu stays. I'm going to go back to their stories really quickly, just so you know who they are. Lao Tzu, he's born in about 600 BCE. He is a librarian. And he works as a librarian for a very long time. He must read lots of books. And he gets tired of it one day. He's pretty old. And he decides he's going to go and walk the entire length of China to the border, the western border. So he does that, and on the way, he begins to teach, and people find out that he's really this wise old guy. And the emperor hears that he's leaving the country. And so he sends word to the border guards to stop him and make him write down all his wisdom. So when he gets to the border, they say, hey, you can't leave until you write down everything. And that becomes the Tao Te Ching. So it's a book, very small book of poetry, and that's the story about where they get that from. So you can see some of the writings there. And this is an older copy, has the T in it for the Tao. But very different from Confucius. Confucius is interested in kind of rational philosophy. Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching is interested in poetry to kind of reveal the Tao. So.
Is he the art of war guy?
No, that's, what's his name?
Sun Tzu.
Sun, yeah. What's his name?
Sun Tzu.
Sun Tzu, is it? Or Sun, yeah.
Yeah.
I have not read that book, but
okay.
He takes the same kind of principles of the two. He's another teacher.
But he's not a disciple.
Of Lao Tzu? No, I don't know. Anyone know when he writes The Art of War?
No.
I think it's closer to first century. We'll look that up.
I noticed that this is akin in some ways to Western wisdom. Is that?
Does it feel like it?
It feels like it. I don't know if that's the intention or.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it feels like kind of some existential poetry,
okay,
maybe that's written, or if you read in the Ecclesiastes a little bit,
sure.
Or yeah. Okay, so. Lao Tzu and Confucius were, let's do Confucius's. Confucius was born 551 BCE. He was born in a noble family, so his father was very wealthy. He was educated, well educated. Then his father dies and he goes into poverty. And so in poverty, he takes a minor position as a minor government minister. The thing that's interesting about both of them, they have kind of these low roles, librarian and a government minister. And he begins to write for the government, and his wisdom comes out, and then he gets promoted to being kind of the one to set policy for the Chinese, for the emperor. But Confucius was reported to wanted to talk to Lao Tzu. He knew he was a well-renowned wise man. The story is that Confucius comes and visits Lao Tzu, and he thinks he can't even communicate with him. Their only meeting was that Confucius walks away saying he's just a fool. So didn't talk to Confucius about what he wanted to talk about. Okay. Let's look at Taoism, where Taoism is. Kind of its most important points. Four things to know about Taoism to understand it. The Tao is the first thing. What is the Tao? What is it? Anybody want to take a stab at it?
The way.
way, not so much the way, but to me that the comparison between Brahman as the unmanifest in Hinduism and Tao, because the Tao is called the unmanifest, uncut, usually called the uncut block. So what it is everything comes from the Tao. The Tao is undefinable, but it's an energy that is behind all things. And so everything flows out of the Tao, the energy of the Tao. And the Tao can be known. And that's the art of Taoism, is it can be known, but the Tao, the way the Tao manifests to the external world is through the power of, called Te. Basically, energy that is revealed. Energy revealed through yin-yang duality. So the way the Tao, it's a flow. The way the energy goes and is revealed in Tu, nice Chinese long words, right? Tao, Tu. Energy that comes out manifesting in this yin-yang duality. Dynamic duality. And then from Tu, you have the individual Qi. So Qi is the energy of everything in the world, its own energy. And the energy flows through things like water. And the way to practice Taoism in the end is called Wu Wei. Flow. So at its most basic, that's the four-part understanding of Taoism. You have this unmanifest energy that is not definable, kind of resides in the void. It reveals itself through Tu, and then each individual energy has its own Qi. So when you, if you study Chinese medicine or practice, they talk a lot about Qi. And qi is what flows through you, and so to practice Taoism is to meditate and find out how to remove obstacles to your qi. The more obstacles you can remove, the more the qi can flow through you, and you can be connected to the qi that is in everything else. Because everything is a dynamic energy. Energy needs to flow, so the qi of living things and non-living things needs to be in harmony and flow together. So the ultimate understanding of Taoism and practicing is to, you know, move like water. Water is kind of the primary symbol. Water flows, and then give me your example again.
A drop of water can wash away a stone.
Right.
Don't wear away a stone.
So the power of the flow of energy, whether in water, it can, you know, make mountains into plains. The same thing can happen if you can access that kind of power in yourself, you can overcome all things. And the idea of being in Wu Wei and having flow is that you will be in control of all the energies of your body. You will live. The Taoist masters were, you know, reportedly can live as long as they want. Hundreds of years up in the mountains. They're, you know, 100, 200, 300 years old, reportedly. I don't know how you prove it, but and so the practice Wu Wei, how many people have seen or practiced Qigong, which is kind of an overview of the Tai Chi, is another subset of Qigong. So what's the, there's a static practice of Qigong or Tai Chi, there's a dynamic practice, and then there's a meditative practice, and sometimes they're all combined, especially in Westerners like to combine them all. So if you see, you go to the mall in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. at lunchtime, you can see all the people practicing their Tai Chi or their Qigong. What does it look like?
Yeah. People are I've seen it in Korea anyway. People are always moving.
They're moving very slowly. And what you're doing is you're trying to feel the energy moving in your body, and you're trying to feel the energy moving, you know, in everything around you as well. And so as you move through forms, they're somewhat like yoga forms, but they're slowly moving forms practice is different depending on the teacher, but so let's try something and turn into a little Tai Chi practice. Okay, this is the tip of one hand is very powerful. The palms of your hands are one of the most powerful flowing places because of the energy that you use with your hands in your life. So you can close your eyes if you like, you don't have to, but just put your palms up. And try to get a sense of the energy flowing through your arms. And which way is the energy flowing if you focus on your palms? Can you feel the energy coming off your hands? Usually it flows out away from your hands, out of your palms. So if your palms are up, you feel energy moving up out of your hands. And the next thing is, a couple feet apart, turn your palms towards one another. And so if your energy is coming out of your palms, you should feel pressure in a very subtle way that is pushing your hands out. I don't know if you have the sense of that you have to almost hold the energy in like a ball. And now slowly, very slowly, move your hands together, palm to palm. Don't touch them, but see if you can sense the difference in the concentration of energy as you slowly bring your hands together. We'll do that quietly. Keep them close together, not touching. If the energy of each palm is meeting one another, there should be kind of a dynamic pressure in between your hands on a very subtle level. Now slowly move your hands apart and try to note any change that you can sense. And energy or pressure. Turn your palms up again. Well, then slowly, do you feel a difference? Turn your palms back together. Okay, you can open your eyes now. Now the interesting thing to me, did anyone feel anything? Yeah. Is it your imagination? I think the most interesting thing when you compare it to physics and biophysics is you have energy working through your body all the time, electrical energy. You have electrical energy that flows on a very subtle level, which is provable. And if you have electric energy flowing through your body, what does that produce? Magnetic field. So it is no doubt by scientific means that you can see how the magnetic fields in your body are, you know, in relationship with each other. So it's not all your imagination. See if you become Tai Chi masters. So that's basic Taoism. Let's look at the basics of Confucianism. Religious scholars consider these two to be almost two sides of the coin of one another. A Taoist might not want to say that he's the flip side to Confucianism, but as kind of outside observers looking at it, they're two aspects of one another. Confucianism, basically, Confucius wants to order society well. He doesn't care about God, he doesn't care about the spirits, he doesn't care about any of that, except maybe with ancestor worship. And he only uses that to reinforce the sense of the values and the duties of the citizen. So Confucianism, if you can see on your notes, we'll just go to that in here. On the back, to understand the basics of what Confucianism is about, are the two sets of five. There's the five great relationships and the five virtues. So you can see that on the back of the term sheet. So So the first most important relationship, and Confucianism is male dominated, but you can gender neutralize it if you like. I'll try to do that a little bit. But the first one is father-son or parent-child. So understanding that relationship and where you fit within that and what is the appropriate way of being and the appropriate action in that relationship. Understanding that and practicing that while cultivating that. You can see how this moves into Chinese society or Asian society, how it's much more communal than the West, coming that comes right out of Confucius ideals. So father, son, and then the next one is sibling relationship. You know how to act like an older sibling. You know how to act like a younger sibling. There's an importance that you maintain that good relationship for the order of society. Then husband and wife. Interesting that spouse relationship is third. I think that's a little different than the West. Then elder, younger, and that's in the sense of my elders, grandparents, that kind of thing. And then finally, ruler and subject. So the emperor would be at the top of the Confucian relationship, and the citizen knowing their duties and their actions within that system. The five virtues, and we can look at that on the term side. We flip the sheet. We have those spelled out a little bit better. The five Confucian virtues, run. Run is the virtue that good friends have, the virtue that cements relationships together. That's the most important Confucian virtue, that you know what it takes to make a relationship work. You know, what is it, what do you have to do to make a friend? What are those things that, those qualities? I could ask for them, I suppose. What are those? We'll do that. What's friendship made out of?
Time.
Spending time, okay?
Respect.
Respect.
Energy.
Energy, giving energy to the relationship, yeah.
Gift giving.
Giving gifts.
Reciprocity.
Yeah, reciprocity is actually considered, shu is a word they use to describe that. So all those things, the symbol for ren is two people walking side by side. So that's the first Confucian virtue. The second one is called li, and it's just understanding proper behavior, understanding what is required of you at all times. That's Li. Shu is an interesting one. That is reciprocity. And I just find it fascinating and very Eastern. In the West, we have the golden rule. Jesus says what?
Do unto others.
Right. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's very Yang, is it not? So what is Confucius flips it over, and it's the silver rule. Do not do to another what you would not want done to yourself. I find that fascinating. That
it is
the opposite. You know, here's East, here's West. It reflects yin and yang perfectly.
There's some, even in some of the Old Testament rabbis, in their commentaries, they use that same kind of teaching, the silver rule.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, where is that at?
I don't know if it's Hillel or who it is, but they use that same kind of...
Cool. And then Middle East is right in between there.
Yeah.
So, you know, East and West. So Shu is the third virtue. Xiao is called, it gets translated filial piety. We don't really use that word, but being a good son, being a good daughter, and also being a good parent, but it's really understanding your place, filling that role in the proper way, having good character. And then Wen is the virtue of being a cultivated person. So the noble person, the Junzi, is a cultivated person. They know poetry. They know theater. They know music. They know art. They cultivate all those things in themselves. That's what a superior, noble person does. So you can see that in Chinese society, too, a very strong focus on the arts. Okay. Any questions about that?
I have an off-the-wall question.
Yeah.
How do they rationalize female infanticide having this type of philosophy?
Yeah. That kind of male-dominated thing has really kept itself sunk into Chinese society. I don't know that I could answer that from one or the other. I mean, maybe from Confucianism, because it was dominantly male. You know, the original relationships are father, son, husband over wife, brother, elder brother, younger brother. So, you know, from that perspective, everything is seen in male eyes. If you can only have one child, which is a newer thing for China, you know.
Yeah, but it's 4,000 years of female infanticide. I mean, it's been
sure.
Okay, I mean, their whole
system. And they still don't look. Yeah, it's a contradiction that they live
right.
the Tao, and yet.
Yeah, and that female question, you know, I mean, I think you could answer it from the yin and the yang, because the female principle is the passive principle, then it allows them, you know, in a sense, the male is the dominant principle, so the male will, in those ways, those external ways, try to be, you know, dominant over the female principle. I mean, if I was going to try to explain it out of that's the only thing I can
practice. It's always baffled me a bit. Because it's all about being balanced, and culturally, you seem to always hit
that. Yeah, that's not in balance anymore. All right, any other questions about that stuff? There's a nice Taoist story here. I'm not going to get into it, but Shi, the carpenter, kind of a typical Taoist story. This comes from the Zhuangzi. Zhuangzi is the next teacher after Lao Tzu. He comes in a few hundred years later. And Zhuangzi is very well known for his stories. One of the stories about him is that when his wife dies, he sings and dances and horrifies the whole village. And, you know, that as a teacher, that's just, he's saying he knows that this is the way things are. He doesn't go into mourning. This is one of his stories called Shi the Carpenter. You can read it for yourself. Shi is actually a Chinese word that means to be. It's the word for is, so there's a sense of beingness about this story as well. Okay. A little bit of time. Let's go back to the Tao Te Ching. Since we didn't really get to read that. Taoism is the mystical side of Chinese practice. It is, you know, Zen Buddhism approaches Taoism, but Taoism is seeking to get into the secret essence of the Tao, to understand how energy works, to control all the systems, all the energy that's in the body and even outside the body, to the fountain of youth kinds of things. So let's see. Rich, you talked about kind of seeing the reflections of other wisdom in here. Let's see if we can see it. Somebody read number one. Maybe not.
Yeah, sure. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternal real. Naming is the origin of all particular things. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestations. Yet mystery and manifestations arise from the same source. This source is called darkness. Darkness within darkness, the gateway to all understanding.
Okay. So in this one, this is the very first poem in the Tao Te Ching. And it kind of sets everything up. You can see the yin and the yang. You can see the emphasis on the yin and the darkness as the power. And yet both are present. That which is manifest, and that which stays hidden in mystery. And so all that working through the poetry, you can see that there. How about number two, the third part of that, the third paragraph?
Therefore the master acts without doing anything, and teaches without saying anything. Things arise, and she lets them come. Things disappear, and she lets them go. She has but doesn't possess, acts but doesn't expect. When her work is done, she forgets it. That is why it lasts forever.
Okay. So what do you notice about that one, especially? And so Taoism, especially because the Tao is often feminized, even though it's neither male nor female, the Tao is often called the Great Mother as the source of all things. So yeah, it kind of balances that male dominance equation there. So, you know, that's in the second poem, the second page in the Tao Te Ching, so you can see how. So let's try four, this is good. See, in Taoism, we're not afraid to sit in silence until the voice manifests itself.
The Tao is like a well, used but never used up. It is like the eternal void, filled with infinite possibilities. It is hidden but always present. I don't know who gave birth to it. It is older than God.
It is older than God. People say, is Taoism, is it a deistic or theistic religion? And the answer is probably not, maybe. when you go to Taoist temples, you'll see gods all over the place, like we talked about Hinduism and Buddhism. The same principles are at work. Neo-Taoism, Neo-Confucianism looks a lot the same. Statues and prayers to gods. And there's a Taoist trinity, there's a Taoist godhead. We don't have time to get into that, but that has kind of crops up over time, too. It's not the core, but it is present, too. But you can see in number four how, you know, the sense of why the yin and the darkness is not an evil or negative thing. It's really seen as source. The void is source. Okay, let's see. Oh, five is good, too, so let's see five. They're all good. We'll just keep on rolling these.
The Tao doesn't take sides. It gives birth to both good and evil. The Master doesn't take sides. She welcomes both saints and sinners. The Tao is like a bellow. It is empty and infinitely capable. The more you use it, the more it produces. The more you talk of it, the less you understand. Hold it on to the center. Mm-hmm.
Something sound familiar in there, Christians? Welcoming both saint and sinner. Yeah. Sounds cool.
And the Tao is like a bellows. To me, that's like the spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, some similar language. Hold on to the center. There's that balance point. There's that center of the yin and the yang. You know, the Tao incorporates both, and it's all contained within the Tao. So.
Let's do 19.
19? Go for it. Yep.
Throw away holiness and wisdom, and people will be 100 times happier. Throw away morality and justice, and people will do the right thing. Throw away industry and profit, and there won't be any thieves. If these three aren't enough, just stay at the center of the circle and let all things take their course.
There you go. Yeah, how does that play? Throw away holiness and wisdom. Throw away morality and justice. Is that shocking it around?
I feel like it's giving, like, saying it, throwing it away, like it's taking away the definition of those words and removing the duality. So, like, without defining that, you know, there is no, you're not polarizing those.
Yes.
Those.
You see the whole, right? Mm-hmm. If it's sacred or if it's profane, yeah, if you remove that, then you can see the sacred in everything. And then, and actually, Shur the Carpenter, he picks that up a little bit too. Ranger, let me see if I can find it. At the end, I kind of piece this together. You have to read the whole thing. It's about a tree. Shur's apprentice sees this huge tree and is in awe of it. And the carpenter says, well, the only reason it's big is because it's worthless wood. Nobody wanted to use it for anything. And then talks about the value of being worthless. And so it's this back and forth balance, which, you know, the Taoist masters and the Zen masters are always doing, kind of shocking you or moving you out of one thought position to another, back, you know, not letting you stay in one place. So it's kind of beautiful at the end. So somebody read that last part on the right.
Okay.
So if, then whom shall I ask to be the judge? Someone want to read that?
Then whom shall I ask to be the judge? Shall I ask someone who agrees with you? If he already agrees with you, how can he be a fair judge? Shall I ask someone who agrees with me? If he already agrees with me, how can he be a fair judge? Shall I ask someone who agrees with both of us? If he already agrees with both of us, how can he be a fair judge? Then if you and I and others cannot decide, shall we wait for still another? Waiting for changing opinions is like waiting for nothing. Seeing everything in relation to the heavenly cosmos and leaving the different viewpoints as they are, we may be able to live out our years. What do I mean by seeing things in relation to the heavenly cosmos? Consider right and wrong, being and non-being. If right is indeed right, there need be no argument about how it is different from wrong. If being is really being, there need be no argument about how it is different from non-being. Forget time, forget distinction, enjoy the infinite, rest in it.
So I have the same experience every time I teach Taoism as I'm trying to give definition to it. I feel the Tao pressing on me, putting me...
I am undefinable.
Trying to fill up the emptiness when you're just supposed to let the emptiness fill up itself. It's always the same.
So does the Taoist or the Confucianist have any view on life after this life? It's mostly about living your best life here, kind of.
Confucianism definitely about now, living life now within society, not really looking to what comes after, although the ancestor worship part is there. Taoism is about, you know, the sense of Buddhism when we talked about, in a psychological way, tries to get beyond this reality, outside of mind, into pure consciousness. I think a Taoist master is trying to do the same thing in instead of psychologically in mind, it's more in the energy of the spirit. Very similar, yet different. And so, you know, reality is a subtlety beyond this revealed world. And they are trying to access that and through their own self. Everything is found within, in Taoism. The Tao is in here. The Tao that makes everything out here is right in here too. So where do you find the Tao? You have access by going in. And once you unite with the Tao on the inside, then you're united with the Tao on the outside. And then all things are possible. So, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I was just curious, like, we all have this expectation of eternal life and that kind of thing.
Right.
So they're just living in the present, here and now. Here and now is the future too for them.
The Tao is now.
It's always.
There is no really past or future.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even in Christianity we get there too, right? The kingdom of heaven is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus is saying that a lot. And so I think it's similar in that way. Where the Tao is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, just is. The Tao is. There's no, you know, as soon as you start to put definition to the Tao, you lose. Mm-hmm. And you're
abstract.
Yeah.
Very
interesting. Yeah, it is. Yet powerful, even in the concrete. So, let's pray. How's that? Lord God, we thank you for studying Taoism and Confucianism, seeing how wisdom from China and the East reflects the different parts of your world. Help these things to inform us and to see how your grace is revealed in many different ways. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
What's the theme tomorrow, John?
The theme tomorrow is it's a fun one. This is hard to teach, but tomorrow we're going to do Judaism and Christianity together, and I don't feel like I can teach you anything about Judaism so much or Christianity, but I will show you something about Jewish society in the first century and the reading of the Gospels that I think will surprise you. And you'll be I'll teach you something new and bring those two together. So. Yeah.